One, invitation. This text began with an invitation to produce, and I quote, something like a mutant crossing of Robert Smithson's Monuments of Passaic, Mirror Travels in the Yucatan, crossed with Chris Marker's La Jetée. So wrote a curious and optimistic journal editor. What a perfect impossibility this would be. Marker's poetic photographic essay, Smithson's Geopoetics. Something that might account for your journey across both nuclear books, he said, which would consist of your photographs and images. In other words, tennis courts, highways, plaques, maps, trees, barges, warning signs, stones, obelisks, deserts, symbols, drawings. No stray dogs, no suckling pigs. Two, images. What follows is an intentionally unfinished text in relation to the curious invitation driven by images taken from two book projects. Some of this was published in an architectural journal from Columbia. This is not so much a dialogue with the images as it is a set of reflections or captions occasioned by these images. I am not a photographer. My photographs are simply vague testimony, bookmarks, gestures, suggestions. A history, in other words, written not with lightning, but close. A history written with the energy of restless, recalcitrant matter. There are 26 passages of varying lengths. Three, sight. Great Bear Lake in Canada's Northwest Territories is a vast inland sea, nearly 31,000 square kilometers. On the far eastern shore, where no one lives today, just below where the tree line cuts across the immense glacial body of the lake, carved into barely fathomable depths sometime in the late Pleistocene, at the far end of what is now called McTavish Arm, buttressed in ancient granites by the very western edge of the Precambrian Shield, lies Port Radium. This land, home to the Satu Dene for some number of millennia, is also a site of considerable significance for Canada's atomic history, a point of origin, one might say, where a frontier economy, with its currency of fur, shifted awkwardly toward the very contemporary projects of an atomic modernity. From here on Great Bear Lake, uranium ore was transported south by river and rail, leaking as it went, for processing at Port Hope, Ontario, and then into the productive centers of World War II, the Manhattan Project, as it was conventionally known, subsequently extending itself over the clear morning skies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and back again into the Dene community at Delaunay in the form of cancers, stories, addictions, and depression. Four. Field note, Yellowknife, August 2004. The morning spent with an exquisite map of Great Bear Lake by the Mundy Map Company of Edmonton. It was produced at the time that the radium boom took place on Great Bear Lake in 1930, in response to the influx of would-be claim stakers, many refugees from the Yukon Gold Rush and the economic depression in the south, most looking to relieve the Precambrian cliffs of pitchblende, the source of radium. You could smell it, they said. Five, punctum. And then this, taken at Port Radium in 1930, this image, like many in the archive, is undated, the people unnamed. This one, though, is striking. It is hard to know how to address it, a simple staged photograph. The snow makes it look like spring, both reading, one a look of consternation, or is it disbelief? The other partially perched on a shipping drum with a look of amusement, delight. They don't look like Dene. The parkas suggest that they are Inuit, visitors from further north. I inquired with the archive in Yellowknife. Could they, I asked, take a closer look at the negative and tell me perhaps the date on the Astro Digest magazine? It looks like it appears on the lower right of the cover. And was there any other information about the image itself or the unnamed readers pictured? A couple of hours later, I received this reply. Hi, Peter. The only caption we have was added by the archivist. Unidentified man and woman reading magazines at Port Radium. And actually, it's a print, so I'm not able to make out the cover information either. Sorry. So much for that. What is it that strikes me here? The glasses, the pose, their anonymity, the heavy gloves, the likelihood that neither of them would possess the mode of literacy that now pervaded their place, the advertisement for the notorious Border Blaster radio station, XEAW, the chilling, dramatic irony of the just visible supertitle, Tomorrow's Headlines. Six, index, the photograph, a scandal. Yes, it is chafed and wounded by the real, no dispute here, but it is not exhausted by it. One must always know something more. Seven, El Dorado. Another way to tell this story is that it begins or ends at a place quite far from here at Library and Archives Canada. Of particular interest to me, this archive is home to some 34 meters of objects, more often called records, belonging to El Dorado Nuclear Limited. From the terra nullius of the mid-depression Canadian North, El Dorado was to invent a decidedly modern North, not once, but twice, from a site on Great Bear Lake at a place known to some as Port Radium. From this place, El Dorado pioneered two uniquely modern Canadian staples, staples that created strange loops between the pre-modern fur trade routes and the very deadly projects of atomic modernity. This particular North began in 1930 with one of the richest mines in the world, a mineral museum, it was called, featuring an abecedaire of minerals and metals, but most valuable of all was the radium-bearing pitch blend. At the time, radium, the most valuable commodity on Earth, was held to be a substance of miraculous power. It was action at a distance, a tonic for health, scourge of the cancerous cell. And in the second instance, this time at the very dawn of the Second World War, with an El Dorado transformed and fortified as a corporation of the Crown, as an allied source of strategic uranium, ore that made its transformed debut at Alamogordo in July of 1945, and then reprised shortly thereafter over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The aptly named El Dorado Archive is a kind of a black box, a grail on the highway of the atom. Largely inaccessible to researchers since the time of its deposit, it contains papers, the reports, minutes, and draft, the marginalia and maps, photographs, sketches, tables and figures that collectively might, one could imagine, divulge something about the details of Canada's involvement in a war effort to invent something that promised to eradicate war itself. It is thus a repository, a fantastic abridgment of testimonies and stories of considerable interest to those who may wish to understand this time through the optic of what was kept and concealed of the remains. And although I have barely begun to traverse this potlatch of objects, what I know already is what is not contained in this archive, or what is made present only as an absence. Like so many projects that have and continue to take place in the north of Canada, this archival absence refers to the stories of those people who actually lived there, that labored on the highway of the atom, who watched as their lands were contorted into a site of national self-realization. Yet their story, their stories, remain closed for us in different ways as well. Of course, they are inaccessible, if we mean by that geographically remote, a pious and ironic alibi. But more than this, they are closed because we have not had ears with which to hear them. But this wasn't just a story of the dynamics of margin and center in the development of a staple, although it certainly is that. Nor is it just a vignette within the larger arc of Canada's atomic history, although it is that too. There is more. The Dene never really realized what they were up to. There were white guys and machines. It was very busy, and there was money. In any case, having already undergone the catastrophe of the church, found themselves more or less permanently ensconced in a village, the mining was just another thing happening on their land. It wasn't until much, much later in the 1990s that the Dene came to realize that the project that they had been involved in was in fact killing them and had culminated in the massacre of over 227,000 Japanese civilians and 30,000 or so Korean laborers. Eight, blind field. Roland Barthes tells us that the blind field is in some way constituted by something that remains on the outside of the image, or perhaps just certain images. A kind of subtle beyond, as if the image launched desire beyond what it permits us to see. Beyond the image, yet occasioned by it. Its lineage does not derive from the operator, photographer, author, tourist, agent, whatever. It begins there, one might suppose, but this beginning is also the moment of its occlusion. Where Charles Peirce might point to a blind compulsion, evoking an existential bond, the clap of thunder that follows the lightning, and Barthes, the that has been, as a nominal, if melancholic, certification of something, the blind field leads us outside. Its itinerary is an elsewhere of the image. The blind field, a ghostly intrusion, a disturbance, a return of the dead. Nine, wounds. To approach the history of the nuclear is in a way to deal with a blind field of culture. In 1917, Freud wrote about the great wounds of the Western civilization of his time. The wounds that undermined the universal narcissism of men, he said. The three severe blows from the researches of science. The first had to do with the dwelling place, the earth, the oikos, and its place in the cosmos as the unmoving center. This, he said, is associated in our minds with the name and the work of Copernicus. The first blow was thus the cosmological one. The second wound concerns animals and the gulf presumed between their nature and ours. We all know, wrote Freud, that a little more than a half century ago, Charles Darwin and his collaborators put an end to this presumption on the part of man. This was the second great wound, the biological one. The third, the most wounding of all, thought Freud, was psychological in nature. And this, of course, was his own theory of the unconscious. Scandalously, the ego was not master in its own house. The cosmological, the biological, and the psychological. The oikos wounded, the exception effaced, and the subject divided. And to this trinity of injury, one could posit a fourth. With the advent of the nuclear, the security of the future as a pact of temporal continuity is largely abolished. The decisive accident may already have taken place. Our responsibility no longer hinges on our continuity, but on protecting the future from placeless, toxic matter. Welcome to the Anthropocene. The fourth wound, we may say, is ontological. Ten, disaster. Until quite recently, the Dene of Great Bear Lake and many others along the highway knew nothing of radioactivity. Why would they? How would one even translate such a concept? In Inuktitut language, I am told, the concept of half-life translates as half-human. In Slavey, the language of the Dene, there just are no words to translate this. For the Dene, as it appears to me at considerable distance, all of this was instrumental in a process of completely resignifying the preceding half century, memory itself came under siege by a knowledge that had the power to rewrite and resignify. It's not that the pieces started to fall into place. There were just pieces falling. An imperceptible tide of suspicion washed over the past. In a stroke, lives lived in and around the mine, on the river, the portage, and the lake were transformed into something quite different. The health and abundance of the fish and game, the unimaginably vast lake, the land upon which everything depends, all of this was thrown into question. Domestic life, the very intimacy of the home, the oikos, was also and retroactively contaminated. Families began to recall that they had been living with radioactive ore dust, ore bags repurposed for domestic and sanitary uses, contaminated building materials scavenged and used elsewhere. Details gathered new and grave significance. Dust and dirt became tailings. Hands not washed became precautions not taken. Caribou and fish were freighted with risk, even and perhaps particularly the deaths of those who had already passed were no longer secure. Symbolic death denied to the dead. In this way, the past, their past, was itself rendered toxic by virtue of a retroactive catastrophe of knowledge, a traumatic reversal toward events not experienced as traumatic in the first place. Not a history of disaster, but history as disaster. Eleven, rhyming. Fukushima, Hiroshima. A vexatious rhyme, as Nancy observes, linking together the civilian atom with the military atom. He writes, "It is not possible to ignore what is suggested by the rhyme of these two names, for rhyme gathers together, reluctantly, against all poetry, the ferment of something shared. It is a question, and since March 11th, 2011, we have not stopped chewing this bitter pill of nuclear energy itself." Twelve, accident. At the time I was writing Highway of the Atom, there were then two great nuclear indices, Three Mile Island in 1979 and Chernobyl in 1986. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a kind of third index, forever linked in a proprietary piece of geopolitical disavowal. Didn't it end the war? In North America, these events stand as repressed adventures particular to wartime endeavors. In a word, they were not accidents. Today things have changed, although at this point it is difficult to say precisely how. It has certainly become clear that an earthquake and tsunami zone crowded with 127 million people is a risky site for 54 aging nuclear reactors. And this anxiety, of course, might reverberate here too. Beaver Lodge, Uranium City, MacArthur River, Cigar Lake, Rabbit Lake, and so on. 13, Nome. Project Nome was the first of 27 domestic nuclear detonation experiments conducted under the auspices of the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Department of Energy, Operation Plowshares. Located within sight of the future waste isolation pilot plant, the Nome detonation involved a 3-kiloton nuclear device buried 1,184 feet below ground in sedimentary salt. With great local fanfare, including Edward Teller giving an inspirational talk at the high school in Carlsbad and buses to bring over 500 visitors to observe the detonation. We recall that Teller had previously lured a crowd in Alaska by saying that nuclear explosives could be so controlled as to dig a harbor in the shape of a polar bear if desired. The experiment took place on December 1st, 1961, Although it was intended as a fully contained explosion, within several minutes of the detonation, vapor began venting into the atmosphere, sending a radioactive cloud across the region. It wasn't until 1977 that the Department of Energy began to decontaminate the site. An hour down the road, you could have lunch underground at the spectacular Carlsbad Cavern, run by the National Park Service. The WIP. On March 26, 1999, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, the world's first permanent underground disposal facility for nuclear waste, received its first shipment. It arrived by truck from Los Alamos National Laboratory. The WIP was to have continued in operation until 2039 or so, and then would be sealed shut. Once filled and closed, they would then need to attend to the matter of the design and construction of a warning system to ensure the security of the site for a regulatory period of 10,000 years, 300 generations. They'd been working on this. What no one involved could see coming arrived, predictably, a year ago on February the 14th, when waste drum 68660 experienced a violent exothermic reaction. It exploded, contaminating the underground facility, exposing 22 workers, and causing a series of plutonium and americium releases at the surface, something that could never happen. So 15 years and $19 billion into its 10,000-year life, the WIP is now shuttered. One other thing about the WIP. As you probably know, inorganic kitty litter is often made with a particularly absorbent form of clay called bentonite. Bentonite-based kitty litter is also routinely used by the nuclear waste industry as a desiccant to stabilize highly acidic and other liquid radioactive wastes for disposal. Organic kitty litter, on the other hand, is not made from bentonite. It is made from wheat. While bentonite stabilizes and moderates chemical heat-producing reactions, organic kitty litter, in this context, acts as fuel. It produces the makings of a bomb. Since September 2012, Los Alamos has packed over 5,000 barrels of radioactive waste, including waste drum 68660, with organic kitty litter, brand named Sweet Scoop, but mislabeled it as inorganic kitty litter. It took an explosion and the crippling of the only functioning nuclear waste repository before anyone noticed this oversight. Field note, Siglichik, Arctic Red River, 6th of August, 2005. The Norweda, the Mackenzie riverboat I've been traveling on, arrives midday. 14 eagles sunning themselves at the mouth of the river. I think it was 14. I can find no fish being smoked, no bales tied and waiting for transport to Aklavik, all that Harold Innes saw on the occasion of his visit. It is hot. There's an inviting pond on the large delta area at the confluence of the Red and Mackenzie rivers. And high above stands the village. Walking through town, I stop and speak with an old woman who's standing near the church. I ask her about swimming in this pond. No, she says, and then tells me a long story. After one of the innumerable battles between the Gwich'in and the Inuit, scores of Inuit were thrown into the pond, the wounded to drown, and all the bodies were just left in the lake. Ever since this time, she said, the eagles wait for the bodies to rise, but all that emerge are ghosts. The pond is too full of ghosts. There's just no room to swim. She uses a slavey word to describe when this happened. I think it means the really long ago time. Just too many ghosts. Signs. It's not Chernobyl, the Japanese authorities were chanting for weeks, even as the international nuclear event scale ratcheted up to 7, and the unmistakable signature of fission isotopes scattered across Japan and the Pacific, and then North America and beyond. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, in keeping with their well-documented practices of concealment and misinformation, scrambled to understand the magnitude of the catastrophe, but no one would acknowledge that the situation was completely out of control or that within 3 days the disaster had already taken place. For the Japanese, there was nothing there, there was nothing to be seen, leaving them dependent on others, the same others that produced the threats, to determine the appropriate semiotic means with which to represent it back to them and for them. But it was just signs in the wind. What is dangerous and what is safe? What dosage is hazardous and what is not? Such thresholds and limits obscure the fact that they are foremost creatures of politics, not the laboratory, objects of persuasion, not measurement. Quipped an Oregon dairy farmer a few weeks into the event, for the time being, we produce cesium. Tsunami. Japan, until recently, one of the world's most nuclearized nations. A nation that in every conceivable way had internalized their atom, attempted to master its traumatic history with the atom as producer, champion, as apologist, as perpetrator, and as victim again. While we are the victims, we are also the perpetrators, wrote Haruki Murakami not long after the disaster. We must fix our eyes on this fact. And living as they do at the tectonic confluence, poetically known as the Pacific Ring of Fire, they are also one of the world's most prepared nations for large seismic events. Yet the unimaginable arrived, predictably. The land lurched into motion, matter feigning liquid. Moments later, a horrifying gesture of ocean, with a run-up height of over 120 feet in some places, disavowed the land entirely. And the black box of containment of the reactors became, and perhaps remains, transparent to their environments, a restive catfish and a feral dragon. Stories. In the wake of their realization, as it appears to me, at least, the Dene came to interpret their role in what seems to me a most complex manner, that is, as both accomplice and victim. One can see something of this in stories that have circulated in recent years. I paraphrase a story told by the late George Blondin that references an ancient Dene prohibition about the very site of Port Radium. The Dene had always known it was bad medicine to travel in front of the area now known as Port Radium. It was said that loud noises came from within it. For some reason, a group of Dene hunters had camped there, and in the morning, the medicine man told them of his dream in which he saw white people going into a large hole in the ground with machines. He saw boats on the lake and huge flying birds loaded with things. They were making something long, like a stick, which they dropped on people, burning everyone. This was the future, he said, and it will happen long after we are dead. In counterpoint to the "if only we had listened to what we already knew" tone of this story, another began circulating, a kind of creation story, in which the genesis of the mine itself was predicated on the theft of a pitchblende-bearing rock. In this story, it is Gilbert Labine, the main protagonist in white mining mythology, who steals a rock by trickery from a Dene man by the name of Bione. The rock unlocked the secret of the radium and uranium, for which the Dene, of course, were never compensated, victim and accomplice. To the former, they sought recognition and compensation from the government of Canada. Their land claim negotiations were underway, and this needed to be a piece of accounting. but to the latter, they disavowed the vortex of history and archive and the also vortical administrative discussions of sovereignty, rights, and self-government, and moved directly into the ethical. In 1998, on the anniversary of the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the Dene did something exemplary, unthinkable. They organized a formal expedition to Japan to make a call for peace and apologize to the Hibakusha, the bomb survivors, for their role, their labor, their complicity, unknowing as it was, and foremost, their land, the territorial archive that was now indelibly stained with the record of their collusion. But more than all of the tragic details that came to light, the stories of White and Dene children playing in sandboxes filled with uranium mine tailings, discarded ore sacks used to repair tents and clothing, contaminated materials, the accidents and spills, more than all of this, the apology on the part of the Dene is incomprehensible, unfathomable, taking responsibility for another, a singular work of cultural care, of mourning. What was being acted upon, insofar as I can comprehend any of this, was a kind of imperative, an ethical imperative. Perhaps it really is the case that the ethical and the traumatic spring from the same place, from the same wound. For the Dene, the historical trauma is invented in the same instant as an ethical proceeding is undertaken. It's complicated. The archive ratified a memory of a trauma never experienced as such, and the Dene saw in their own suffering an ethical inducement toward responsibility for the other. The mind reels, or mind does. Field Note, The Work of Art in the Age of Nuclear Waste, September 2014. A note written at the Lieu de Mémoire of Verdun on the occasion of a Nuclear Energy Association meeting on knowledge, records, and memory across the generations, where I was to speak of the Anthropocene and memory. Yesterday, a representative of the Dutch nuclear agency, Corva, made a most astonishing presentation, complete with a slick animation scored with Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach, concerning their temporary repository for high-level waste, HABOG, it's called. The Dutch decided that they must keep their spent fuel at the surface for a minimum of 100 years. The building is quite arresting, actually, a work of conceptual art designed by the artist Willem Verstraeten on the theme of metamorphoses. It's painted bright orange and emblazoned with the equations of Einstein and Planck in big, bright, friendly green letters. And every 20 years, the building will be repainted with a color slightly less bright until 100 years from now, the color will be close to white, helpfully indexing the radioactivity within. And inside, there are huge screens with projections of outdoor scenes that likewise decay over time. Not long ago, the director of the project decided that the extra space inside could be pressed into cultural service. Within a few years, they had entered into agreements with 7 regional museums and galleries, were storing an array of artworks and museum pieces, and running cultural programming throughout the year. Now, leaving aside the plausible observation that this is merely a strategic or cynical attempt to absorb the benediction of art for the waste of modernity, it is a remarkable thing. The aesthetic possibilities of waste, moving away from the abject and sublime toward thinking about this material as a mode of cultural heritage to be curated by us, a keeping place. Does this, I wonder to myself, suggest an alternative to the lonely aporias into which we so often slip with dull razor blades and dark thoughts? Keeping Place. As Jonathan Bordeaux put it, Let me call a site of memory that in principle gives dominance to living witnesses a keeping place, and thus distinguish it from all those depositories of memory where preservation takes precedence over recollection, museums, galleries, archives, and so on. Keeping place, as a designation, opens the possibility for a division between a heritage or generalized legacy and a lieu de mémoire, a site of memory, requiring interested, engaged, and culturally specific custodian witnesses. Such sites are marked by a continuing contestation over custodianship between a hegemonic state-sanctioned practice of memory that acts as if there are no living witnesses, and practices of memory that acknowledge living witnesses who claim these traces to be theirs to curate. Of course, this is it, isn't it? The living witness, imperiled through the practices themselves, the accident, through a custodial practice and public secret that disavows any witness, and through a pure temporality that makes the very possibility of a living witness almost, but not quite, unfathomable. Field note, Emphatic Geography, 30th of July, 2003. At Port Radium, there is an abandoned tennis court. It stands atop the sheer granite cliffs, right at the point where they plunge into the blue, unfathomable depths of Great Bear Lake. This court, this ruin, is surfaced in a remarkable concrete made from pulverized uranium mine tailings. It overlooks another ruin, the decommissioned, that is, bulldozed and abandoned uranium mine. Homo Ludens meets Homo Faber. It is difficult to convey the strangeness of standing there listening to a Geiger counter rendering sonorous the material history of this place, translating the abstract invisibility of energetic matter seeking its own repose. An emphatic geography, as I would come to call it. Recto. Detail of the bronze plaque affixed to a 5-foot concrete marker at Port Radium. It tells the story of Gilbert Labine, the radium discovery, the wartime switch to uranium, the bomb, no mention of its purpose, no mention of Japan, its significance to the mining community and to the North. Verso. The other side of the monument contains two more bronze plaques and one inscription, all interlopers. The first is a commemorative plaque for John Zagarlik of Echo Bay Mines, who in 1963 reinvented El Dorado's abandoned uranium mine as a silver mine. Beneath this, incredibly, another plaque, this one to John Zagarlik's wife, a true northern hostess and a proud northerner. I have no idea what the third inscription is. It looks like a whale. Stones. The Sanriku coastline of northeastern Japan has a particular geomorphology that amplifies the tsunamis that regularly engulf it. In 1896, a 33-meter wave, 23 meters in 1933, and in 1993, a 30-meter wave poured over Okashira Island, again and again. And yet, as if the wall of tsunami rocketing toward the coast that March day in 2011 was not enough, the coastline itself, in a kind of elastic rebound toward the epicenter, sunk about 3 feet, as though bowing toward the oncoming water, rendering the already modest tsunami defenses 3 feet lower. Within minutes of the second wave's arrival, which easily surmounted the 33-foot seawall, the Fukushima Daiichi plant was in a state of total station blackout. They were literally in the dark. Nearly 20,000 people died that day, perhaps more. More than this is speculation. the Globoys, Jumpers, Fukushima 50, Nuclear Samurai, Dose Fodder, Gamma Sponges, all the sacrificial cleanup labor at the nuclear plant, the 120,000 evacuees from the exclusion zone, the virtual body count for what has become the most expensive natural disaster in history. Estimates vary, but figures approaching 600 billion are not uncommon. In the days and weeks following the tsunami, even as the nuclear disaster eclipsed the coastal crisis, survivors began to rediscover gnarled stone tablets. I'm quoting Evan Osnos here from a piece in The New Yorker. Some of them hundreds of years old, which had been left by ancestors at precise points along the shore to indicate the high water marks of previous tsunamis. The inscriptions implored future generations never to build closer to the water again, writes Japanese poet Mariko Nagai. The warnings did come in time, but some did not remember. The warning blared after the earthquake, the tsunami warning that came out of every village and town hall. They were too used to it, too used to the warnings that came nearly every year. They did not remember that this coastline had been plagued with angry waves as long as written words have existed, each devastation chiseled into stones. It is regrets contained in these words, regrets that translate into warnings for the future, for the present. But some had forgotten, so instead they went home, thinking they have enough time. What is the threshold, the semiotic dosage in the present to ensure the transmission to a future? If you remind us too much, we will not listen and thus forget. And if you do not remind us, there will have been nothing to listen to, and we will certainly have already forgotten. Tsunami stones, they're called, another emphatic geography. Two contrasting markers. One, in Canada's Northwest Territories, mining regulations specify that where, because of the presence of a body of water or another natural obstruction in an area, it is not practicable or permitted to erect one of the four legal posts required by subsection 14.1, a witness post shall be erected as near as possible to the place where the legal post would otherwise have been erected. Two, in Japan, near the Anraku Temple in Hiroshima, there is a plaque to commemorate a ginkgo tree survivor of the atomic bomb. The tree itself is very old, grown from a cutting taken from a 12th century tree at Zenpuku Temple in Tokyo. It reads, "This ginkgo withstood the atomic bombing on August 6, 1945. There are still scorch marks on the upper part of the trunk from the blast. The temple, destroyed on that August day, was rebuilt around the tree to protect it. A witness post and a keeping place." I can't really conclude anything here. This is really not my purpose, but I might say that this collection of figures gestured toward problems for us, problems for memory, problems about how it is that one comes to constitute and sustain in memory things not fully experienced to begin with, and how to do this in the face of a history which consumes itself, its witnesses, and its evidence, through the exhaustion of monuments, the erasure of place, and the half-life of memory. Thank you.